This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. And I'm floating in a most peculiar way. And the stars look very different today.
Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 20 of Space Talks. A half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Tell us about the plan for this final episode of Season 3.
I think we can think of this first half of today's show as something of a bit of a poker game. Dealer's choice is what I'm calling it. So we know that Season 3 is drawing to a close, and we're not going to get a chance to get to all the topics that we might wish to. But I thought we could use the first half of the show to each pick one topic that we really want to bring to light. And first, I want to thank you, Steve, for carrying the show last episode when I was away. It was a great topic you picked. And there's nothing friendly about space for people, as we learned, nothing safe for technology either. So I'm going to lead off with a look at what used to be known as the ninth planet, the most distant from the sun. We used to call it Pluto. Still do, actually. And most importantly, I was looking into the cold-hearted way in which a few hundred Earthlings decided to vote Pluto right out of the solar system. Steve, what's your choice?
Well, today with Pocket Aces, I'm going with a topic we've been teasing about all season, and that's exotic stars, or to be more specific, the exotic end states of stars. And when you think about it, we're talking about inert, non-living things, and they transform dramatically at their end, affecting not only their immediate surroundings, but huge distances in space as well. So there you go. We've been dealt our hands, Tim, and you get to play first.
I'm on it. Okay, Pluto. It, of course, was the beloved ninth planet, and now it's a mere shell of itself, Steve, known as a dwarf planet. And the demotion story, that's what I'm calling it, starts way back in, well, not that far back, 2006, at a meeting of the International Astronomical Union. So even though the IAU has thousands of members, all of whom were in theory, I believe, able to vote, only 424 of them showed up for the discussion, and only that many cast votes. And you know what? 10 of them were Canadians.
Well, that's a shocker. Just when you thought Canadians were the nice guys. Thank goodness today I'm wearing my Don't Forget Pluto 1930 to 2006 t-shirt. Tim, what do we know how our delegation voted?
Well, I looked into that, but I actually couldn't find you the truth on that. But I actually do know one of the electors, and his name is Dennis Crabtree, doctor. He turns out he's a very smart fellow, of course, with a distinguished career in astronomy going well beyond Canada. And he did indeed cast his vote for Pluto's dismissal from the Club of Planets, and proudly so, I can tell you. Okay, let's go back to that meeting in 2006, about 20 years ago, when one of the first points of interest in that debate or discussion was just what is the definition of a planet?
You mean to say that prior to that meeting, any old rock of any size could pass itself off as a planet? Talk about posers. However, you know, after some consideration, I suppose this isn't that surprising. For almost all of our history, relying upon either our own eyes or fairly weak telescopes, the night sky was comprised of the moon, a handful of apparently stationary stars, and some bright objects which looked like stars but moved slowly across the sky in a fashion not unlike the moon. And now it's a tip of the hat to the Greeks, famous for that phrase, they have a word for everything.
Okay, so you're talking about a Greek word which English has adopted. Okay, oh. I'm going to go with planet.
Absolutely right, Tim. The Greeks used the word planet, which means wanderer. The ancient Greeks noticed that some stars, which we now know are Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, and they included the moon, moved relative to the backward stationary stars. So tell us about Pluto's discovery and then its demotion.
You bet. We're back in 2006. Astronomers had a fairly robust understanding, and for that matter, they had some photographic evidence of, you know, asteroid belts, the comets that we see, planetary orbits, and so on. So they had to come up with some objective rules for what defined a planet.
Uh-oh, this has got all the hallmarks of design by committee, and that's a derogatory term of the results from a committee having to compromise from the viewpoints of the various participants. Okay, I'll bite. What three criteria were decided upon?
Well, first, and no surprise, this isn't going to drive anybody nuts. It's pretty straightforward. The candidate must orbit the sun, and Pluto does indeed do that, so one check mark. Second, the object must be massive enough for its gravity to make it nearly round. Okay, so think of the images we have of asteroids and comets, and they, of course, don't look anything like round. But Pluto is round enough to get another check mark.
Okay, it's got two check marks, but there's three metrics. Where did Pluto fall short?
Well, it's pretty subjective. I'm going to say I'm not happy about the third one. Pluto flunked out because it failed to clear its orbital path of other bodies of matter. Okay, so Pluto shares its orbit with objects in the Kuiper Belt, which is that region of icy bodies beyond Neptune.
Okay, but let's just go back one step and compare Pluto's size. For instance, how does it compare to Mercury in size?
Well, it's only about half the diameter of Mercury. But one of the other clues about the differences between a dwarf planet and, well, a real one is the comparison of density. Pluto is only a third of Mercury's density, with a composition that's much higher in its proportion of ice and lighter materials.
But wait, there's more, as our friend Ron Popeil would say. Isn't that so, Tim?
You bet there is. Now, as a layperson, I'm going to say that these other chinks in Pluto's armor were quite damning. For example, all of the legit planets that go around our sun are in one plane called the plane of the ecliptic. And for those who wish to conduct some personal research, it's a good idea to look into that. Imagine a flat pancake with eight spots representing planets placed at different distances from the center. Pluto, not so much. It has a very different orbit, Steve. It's tilted relative to the plane by about 17 degrees, marching, you might say, to a beat of its own drum.
Okay, I can sense a Perry Mason moment here as you present yet another piece of incriminating evidence.
You're 100% right. Now, there's the non-circular nature of Pluto's orbit. Now, Earth has a nearly circular trip around the Sun, ranging from a maximum of 152 million kilometers from the Sun and as close as 147 million kilometers. So that's a very small difference, 5 million kilometers. But by contrast, think of this. Pluto's closest and farthest distance from the Sun has a difference of 2,840 million kilometers. And in fact, this is an amazing fact indeed. From 1979 to 1999, Pluto was actually closer to the Sun than Neptune. Who knew?
Well, we do know the Earth is closest and farthest to the Sun each year, whereas the last time Pluto was closest to the Sun was 1866, and the last time it was farthest was in 1989, and that won't repeat again until the year 2227, so don't hold your breath. But all that aside, starting in 1930, we were told, no, make that instructed in school, that there were nine planets in our solar system. And as you say, that wasn't until 2006 when it lost its status. Now kids are taught that there's eight planets in the solar system. I have to admit, Tim, the case against Pluto may not be airtight, but it's space tight.
Wow. Did you really do that on the last show of the season?
Yes, I did. And now it's time to kill some stars, but don't get squeamish, they were never alive. Now, stars, first of all, have round shapes because the force of gravity pulling inwards is offset by the force of energy pushing outwards.
Sort of like a balloon, right? The elastic force of the balloon wants it to deflate, but that is offset by the pressure inside trying to make it expand.
And there you have it, Tim. Our sun will eventually, however, consume its fuel, and the core will shrink while the outer layers expand. And so our sun will, first of all, become a red giant. But the core will continue to shrink, becoming hotter and hotter until it blows off most of its gaseous components into something astronomers call a planetary nebula, which has got nothing to do with planets. So these stars, like our sun, will become white dwarfs.
All right. That's not what we're going to be talking about now, though. It's exotic stars you have in mind. And I love the names, magnetars and blazers. And I want to hold them right now. How do I do that?
Well, here's the skinny on that, Tim. Stars slightly more massive than our sun burn up their fuel and collapse so rapidly that they explode as a supernova, leaving behind a remnant called a neutron star so small it's only 20 kilometers in diameter. Stars much more massive than our sun burn up their fuel, and in an exceedingly rapidly shrinking process, which takes less than a second, they transmute elements into heavier elements such as silicon, lead, silver, and gold.
For the really massive stars, this incredible shrinking rate of fractions of a second continues unabated, and guess what? You get a black hole. That's what's formed. It's hard to believe, but what about these magnetars and blazars then?
Well, if we go backwards just one step to the creation of a neutron star, most neutron stars spin at an incredible rate of 10 times in 1 second. That's faster than a blender. And some spin as fast as 700 times per second.
As one might say, I see the light here, Steve. Now, all stars have magnetic fields, right? And incredibly, small neutron star has all that magnetism compressed to create a super magnet. And the spinning creates, well, it's a furious whirling magnetic field which generates electricity. So, a really powerful neutron star is called magnetar.
Exactly. And if a neutron star creates radio waves which seem to throb as it rotates, we have a pulsar.
Okay, I'm on a roll here. A blazar must be something which is blindingly bright. How about the details on that one?
Well, another shortened explanation here, Tim. A blazar is a galaxy which has an active supermassive black hole at its center. And as mentioned in a previous episode, these spew out massive radiation jets in all wavelengths from the top and the bottom. If one of those jets is pointed at the Earth, it'll be detected as being exceedingly bright, especially in the radio, X-ray, and gamma ray wavelengths.
Now, obviously, we don't have time to drill into this too deeply, so we're going to hope that folks that are interested do some of their own personal research, which has actually always been one of our aims. Well, as we wrap up season 3 of Space Talks, and I might add it's a grand total of 58 episodes to date, this is also going to be the last episode of the show. So, Steve, let's zoom out a bit then and try to stack up the big events, the discoveries, you know, trends that we've seen in the last 3 years, and, you know, sort of categorize them a little bit in terms of astronomy and human and non-human space travel, and, you know, step back and take a big picture look. Steve?
Sure, let's do that. And just for one more time, let's acknowledge that we're not scientists, we're not astronomers, we're not historians, just a couple of wild and crazy guys who like space and its mysteries. So consider this merely as the takeaway from two grizzled fans.
I'd like to start things off, Steve, with the category of human space travel. So this is one of the ones that every once in a while, it kind of makes you laugh. In fact, that's recently the case. You've got things like Jeff Bezos of the Amazon fame and fortune. He's got a company called Blue Origin, and he's been tossing all kinds of people into space on his spacecraft, including his girlfriend and movie stars, TV personalities. And he, of course, is not the only one. Another example of this sort of tourism in space or space travel is Axiom, a company that doesn't really have a very high profile, but, you know, they're training space pilots and they're offering seats on the ISS for a cool $55 million. And then you've got, you know, William Shatner had his chance in space. During the course of our show, I remember one episode, Steve, where we were talking about, I think it was Prada, the fashion company, getting all kinds of attention for a new spacesuit that NASA was going to be using. So what do you think is going to be happening to space travel when it comes to tourists and humans just going up and down for fun? It's crazy, isn't it?
It is. And let's go back to the term astronaut. Now, when my dad was, and your dad too, they were both pilots, when they were training to be pilots, they didn't get their wings. They weren't called pilots. They were called student pilots. And it wasn't until they had sufficiently demonstrated proficiency in navigation and flying, soloing and landing and so on, that there was an official ceremony called a wings parade, in which the cadre of student pilots would proudly step forward and individually receive the wings that were pinned to their chest. Slightly differently, When it came time for NASA to create the first seven astronauts, right from the get-go, they were called astronauts. They'd never been in space, but they were given their astronaut wings. Then they began their training and so on. Then they went up in space. Since that time, we've had Gemini and Apollo and astronauts landing on the moon. And they had to undergo tremendously rigorous examinations and proficiency tests. Nowadays, as you said, with Bezos and going up in Blue Origin, and it's a suborbital flight. Yes, they do cross the Kármán line of going over 100 kilometers high. Then they land and they call themselves astronauts. They've had no training whatsoever. And so the naming societies have begun to scale that back and say, no, you're tourists or space tourists. And I think that just as the definition of what a planet was, I think the term for astronauts and taikonauts and cosmonauts is going to tighten up.
It's just another case of standards being dropped. I mean, I don't know, maybe you and I should start calling each other astronauts because we'd like to go to space.
I like
Okay, what else have you
that.
got, Steve?
Well, space stations are already in the news a lot, but you've got the Chinese with their new Tiangong space station, and they really seem to have short and long range plans for that. The ISS, in golfing terms, is on the back nine. And as a matter of fact, just last week, there are some severe elemental cracks in the Russian subsystems on board. And speaking of the Russians, they seem to be wanting to back out of any future participation. I think in the forthcoming space travel ventures, they're going to take a step backwards as the Chinese really step forward. I think ahead of the Americans, and then the Russians will be third. And there's a talk about a space station orbiting the moon. What's that about, Tim?
Well, the space stations, if you go to the idea of one orbiting the moon, it would allow a place for astronauts to arrive from the Earth and get acclimated before they are taken down to the surface, where they might be engaged in mining or other research activities. But there's also the possibility of using these space stations for commercial purposes, orbiting the moon in essentially zero gravity. They can take advantage of that to produce new pharmaceuticals. We've talked about that on the show. Steve, one of the things about the ISS is it's a great example of international collaboration. Obviously, the Russians have been involved with the Americans, and it's been, not entirely uneventful, but generally speaking, for decades, they've managed to set aside geopolitical concerns and collaborate. And you really have to wonder if by the time we're talking about something orbiting the moon, whether that kind of collaboration is going to be possible. And it's a case of Donald Trump having changed so much. I think he's going to have an impact, a huge impact on how countries consider who is a stable long-term partner.
Tim, a little memory bubble just surfaced as you were talking about that. I remember back to when the Americans were first planning to build a space station. It was going to be an all-American venture, and it was going to be called the Space Station Freedom.
I think there's another point of departure here. This is a short one before we move on, is that there are so many new entrants into space. I mean, the India has landed a spacecraft on successfully on the lunar surface, and we've talked in the show about the numbers of countries that are interested in sending people to space or involved in non-human space travel. Maybe it's just the draw of the potential of revenue, or I don't know, but this is no longer a case of Russia and the United States. There's just a great general interest in this. But let's move on then to some of this non-human space exploration. There's been an incredible amount of progress there. And Steve, why don't you tell us about your impressions of radio astronomy?
Back when I first became interested in astronomy, of course, it was basically optical. You look at the planets and you see them moving, and you look at the constellations. Really, that's where I got my interest, trying to recognize constellations and then particular stars. Orion was a favorite of mine. But then, of course, radio astronomy came into its fore, and then telescopes and space took over. But radio astronomy has really come on lately. We've mentioned the CHIME radio setup in Penticton a number of times. And there's one called the Square Kilometer Array, which will enable astronomers to delve into the early universe, study dark matter, and investigate cosmic magnetism. And my next example has a personal appeal to me, and it's called the Zugspitz Radio Telescope, and it'll enhance global radio astronomy networks. And why the personal appeal? Well, my family and I took a cable car ride to the top of the Zugspitz Mountain in Germany way back in 1962.
Well, I'd like to add in some examples of that non-human space travel. You've got a spacecraft called Perseverance. It's now gathering samples from the surface of Mars, and that's for a planned return mission sometime in the 2030s. Now, there's a great example of that long-term planning that goes into a lot of space exploration. And while I'm on Mars, I was really struck during the course of our 3 years of the show about the Ingenuity helicopter on Mars. The NASA initiative, I think that was an incredible breakthrough. I mean, I guess it's not a big deal to everybody, but there's very little atmosphere in Mars. How do you get around with a plane or, in this case, a helicopter? It took a great deal of science. It had 72 flights before it was retired in 2024.
Another big breakthrough, I thought, Tim, was the OSIRIS-REx probe that returned samples from an asteroid called Bennu, and it returned it to Earth. And it was pristine material, and that pristine material pointed to the possibilities of life beyond Earth, and for that matter, pointing to how life might have arrived on Earth. And I think that's a topic we discussed in an episode earlier. European Space Agency currently has JUICE headed to Jupiter and its moons, JUICE being an acronym. It'll explore Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, and they all hold interest for this mission to see if life might be possible there due to an expectation of subsurface liquid oceans. Well, how
Well,
about that?
that's a real surprise to most people that they're exploring moons of Jupiter for potential subsurface liquid oceans. That's quite incredible. We've got to mention how in the course of these last 3 years, the James Webb Telescope has been, well, just an absolutely key driver of discovery. It came online before we started. It came online in 2022, so that was a little bit before us. But it's done so much in the last 3 years, and it's just changed our expectations of the kind of science that is now possible.
Absolutely, it's turned cosmology on its head. Never before have so many studied assumptions and predictions of the formation of the universe taken place in such a short time. And the closest analogy I can think of that is the very rapid development in the understanding of quantum theory, which occurred exactly 100 years ago in the 1920s, spearheaded by the likes of Werner Heisenberg, Erwin Schrödinger, and Paul Dirac. And they entered into what is now known as quantum mechanics. Oh, and by the way, here in Salmon Arm, there was a company truck on our street this morning, and its name, Quantum Tree Services. But Tim, all that I saw in action was a wood chipper, so somehow I doubt the veracity of their name.
Oh, I don't know. First you see the tree and then it's gone. That's could be quantum physics, isn't
I like that, and it's in two places at once. Oh, yeah,
it?
on the ground and in the back of the wood chipper, yeah.
So this the James Webb, one of the things it's been doing that I get pretty excited about is its ability to study exoplanets. Now, quite often they're first discovered by other means, other telescopes. Even citizen scientists are doing a great deal of work there. But once we know where these things are located, then the Webb telescope can really drill into it and find some amazing things that have made news. I know the other day there was evidence of an element that only exists in an exoplanet's atmosphere because of life. And therefore, there's this suspicion that therefore there could be life on that particular exoplanet. Okay, now let's talk about Hubble tension and dark matter, black holes. This is a topic that there's always churn on this. We've seen it in the last 3 years, and it's is the universe expanding at the rate we expect? Is it going to keep on expanding and never stop, or is it at some point going to sort of suddenly collapse back in on itself?
Well, I'm totally surprised with regard to the Hubble tension because The Hubble tension was a term I wasn't aware of, or if I was aware of it, it was way back in the back of my mind. So that is the discrepancy between how fast the universe should be expanding and how fast one metric says it is and the other one says it isn't. So really, the verdict is still out with regard to dark matter. Does it really exist, or are we missing it? Is it forcing a negative gravity, that is an expanding force, or is there something else out there? There have lately been theories that our observable universe is actually in a black hole. It's all beyond me, but it's interesting that these kind of things were not thought of 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, there's probably very few topics that have resulted in so many about faces. I mean, there's so much more. We're so far away from really being able to, I don't even want to say it, definitively answer that question. Seems like there's a lot more work to be done, but a lot has been shown up in the last 3 years. So that's been exciting. Well, Steve, it seems that we've just got so much more to do when it comes to understanding that topic, and it's one that I'll certainly be keeping my eye on.
Well, that falls in line with that old saying, the more I know, the less I know.
Absolutely right. And it'll be fun to see how many of these topics that we aired or talked about evolve even more going down the road.
Now, in conjunction to my interest in radio astronomy, what I find absolutely fascinating is how non-living elements can be arranged and compressed all by nature, and it produces the most dazzling effects. Who could imagine, for example, that hydrogen, the simplest element consisting of only one proton and one electron, could end up forming a star? And stars can create the other elements such as helium, boron, carbon, and so on. And these inert, non-living elements can spin, create magnetism, generate electricity and radio waves, in addition to visible light. The universe is alive with non-living elements, and as you said earlier, it's all fascinating. Tim, it's been a real pleasure collaborating with you. And not reading the script which you sent me, you've greatly helped expand my boundaries of knowledge. Best of good wishes, Tim, with your future as a board member with the Center of the Universe Observatory in Victoria.
Hey, thanks, Stephen. Right back at you. We've just had such a great time with the show. And I actually look back and have one regret that we only did record 3 episodes in the studio together. That's the problem of distances that we had to deal with. And I bet you're going to be like me, Steve. We started out with a strong interest in space travel, astronomy, but that interest has actually grown, certainly for me, leaps and bounds. And I couldn't have been more delighted than to share our exploration with you. It's been a lot of fun.
It has been. And so today we hope you've gained some insights during this last half hour of Space Talks, as we said, because we really have.
So this is Tim Woods signing off.
And Stephen Lowry inviting you to tune in to our 58 podcasts on CKBS's website. We hope you've enjoyed the series as much as we have and left you with more questions than answers. And so we're signing off, but hope to see you again sometime in the near future.